This podcast of the Radio Cafe comes to you via radiocafe.org, where you can find more information and many other podcasts. Technical support comes from Studio X, providing website design, hosting, e-commerce, and social media marketing, serving Santa Fe to the world since 1994. Find out more at studiox.com. And we're listening to chants from a protest that took place in December of 2013 on the one-year anniversary of the brutal gang rape in Delhi, India. I'm very happy now to welcome to the Radio Cafe Ritu Chatterjee. She's a journalism fellow at the Santa Fe Institute. She's a contributing correspondent to PRI's The World. She's based in New Delhi. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. Glad to be here.
So we wanted to talk today about gender issues in India and gender violence. And I think probably the whole world heard about that brutal gang rape on a bus in Delhi, India, several years ago. There are also many other brutal sexual assaults and even murders that have been less publicized internationally. How has India responded, the citizenry, the politicians, at that time, and what's happened since?
So the brutal gang rape that you're talking about, just as a reminder for your listeners, happened in December 2012. And this was in the capital city of New Delhi, where I now live. And it was a young woman, a physiotherapy student in her early 20s, and she was coming back from watching a movie with a friend of hers. It was a man, and they boarded a bus, which happened to not have any other passengers except for five guys who were just looking to, quote-unquote, have some fun, and that led to that brutal attack, which eventually took her life. So immediately following that particular attack, there was a massive response by not just activists, ordinary citizens, ordinary middle-class people in the city and all over the country who aren't the kind of people you would expect to step out of their homes and take the time to protest against something. They came out on the streets and protested. And for several days, as the victim struggled for her life in a hospital, what my friends describe, Delhi was like a fortress surrounded by these masses of people, absolutely fed up of this day-to-day violence that women have to face, this, or at least the day-to-day constant fear of violence that women have to face every time they want to step out of their house. So this particular case really shocked India. It's not that... I think there was already sort of a building momentum in the women's rights movement and the movement against sexual violence. But this was the straw that broke the camel's back in terms of mobilizing ordinary citizens. And the response from the politicians, sadly, initially was hardly any response at all, which I think further angered the people who were riled up about this already. There was a lot of victim blaming, which is pretty typical of a lot of gender violence cases around the world, especially in India. But because of just the sheer number of people on the streets and the anger, their anger about being sort of just sort of fed up with this, having to deal with this every day, that did push the politicians to do something. So immediately, I think in the weeks following the case and the protests, the government set up this group led by a Supreme Court judge, Justice Verma. And the Verma Commission was set up to review India's anti-rape laws and make recommendations for what can be done legally and otherwise to make India safer for women. And there was the Verma Commission report, which they did a very, very good job. In general, all activists and scholars in India and worldwide sort of agreed with almost everything that this report outlined. And one of the consequences of that was toughening of India's rape laws. So we now have a much tougher anti-rape law in India. For example, the lack of physical struggle by a victim initially was considered a sign of consent. But since this case, since the report, since the reform of the law, that's no longer the case. Then a lot of other acts of violence like stalking, molestation, acid attacks. So it's a much more comprehensive law, which includes a lot of the day-to-day kind of risks of violence and outright violence that women face. So, you know, I've been reporting on this for pretty much the last 2 years. And on the first anniversary of this Delhi gang rape in 2013 was right after I moved back home to India from the United States. And even then, there was the sense of hope. And one of the things that many, many young women told me at that time was that, you know, the big change, aside from the legal change, is the cultural change of victim blaming no longer being okay. Again, there's a huge difference, I think, in urban areas, in rural areas, in more educated groups and less educated groups of people. But by and large, I think societally, at the societal level, mostly urban again, victim blaming was no longer being tolerated. Not that people weren't doing it at all, but slowly but surely people were thinking twice before victim blaming. Or if they did, if a politician jumped in and said something stupid about the victim being responsible, you immediately see a response by the media and by ordinary people.
And one of the people who did that, one of the politicians who did that, was actually a woman and a gynecologist.
Yeah, you know, you find I think that's where things really need to change. I think where we're seeing things slowing down is among politicians. And not just this one politician, but for example, my home state, West Bengal. Earlier in the year, in 2012, there was a young woman, middle-class family, educated. She was divorced, had two little girls, was returning from a bar and was gang raped while she was going back home in a cab that she was sharing with men that she'd met at the bar. And the chief minister, who's a woman, her response, again, was victim blaming. Her response was to shut down bars earlier. Sadly, this particular victim actually refused to stay behind sort of the veil of anonymity and came out and revealed her name, Suzette Jordan, and Jordan was very outspoken about against rape, and she passed away earlier this year. But again, like you see, you see it repeatedly. It's not just the men, but you also find women leaders reinforcing patriarchy. But they're being challenged much more vocally than you would have seen like 5 years ago.
Stronger laws, better laws are only as good as law enforcement. How are the police doing historically? How are they doing now? Has there been any change?
That's a fantastic question. And in fact, I think that's another place where India is lagging behind. And it's not just in terms of sexual violence. I think in general, India has one of the toughest and best laws in the world. Where things fail is at law enforcement. Now, what's changed slightly, I wouldn't say a lot, is that, you know, there are efforts to sensitize the police force. I can't say that it's been wildly successful yet and the police is completely reformed in terms of registering or, responding to cases of sexual assault, but it's definitely a lot better than it was 5 years ago or 2 years ago when this particular case happened. Because, you know, now there's enough talk about this in the media that even the ordinary policeman, at least in cities, again, you know, I think in rural areas, rural India and urban India can sometimes be decades apart in where they are in their evolution. But at least in urban areas, I think the police is also likely to respond more quickly now than 2 years ago. Again, is it perfect? No. We have a long way to go because oftentimes victims sort of get re-victimized when they go to the police station. And that's a huge problem. But there is effort, but I think it's way too slow to change that.
It's interesting because there are some paradoxes that you bring out in your work, like the fact that in certain places there's worship of warrior goddesses, and yet in those very same places, women are second-class citizens, and real cases of rape get ignored, victims are blamed, they're molested by the police, and this is where, I guess it's in Bengal, where men are said to be sensitive and women feisty.
Yes, that's my home state. And yeah, if there's one state, I think, where at least in the middle class, in the educated section of the society, gender roles are thought to be a bit reversed. You know, as you said, men are sensitive. They're not really known for their machismo. They're better known for their intellect. And women are considered feisty. And it is kind of, to a certain extent, celebrated as well. But again, I think the problem is at the level of the politicians, at the level of law enforcement. My home state, as you just mentioned, our biggest festival is this Hindu festival where we worship a 10-armed goddess who killed a demon, Goddess Durga. And yet, if you look at the statistics of gender violence, it's pretty high in the state compared to the rest of the country. Again, with a lot of gender parameters, it's a little better, but there is violence. And there are other parts of the country. You know, Hinduism has many goddesses. And so this is a paradox that is true for the rest of the country as well. We have the goddess of knowledge. We have the goddess of wealth. We have the goddess of strength. So these are all goddesses. And yet, when it comes to treating our women well, we don't do it. And it's a really fundamental paradox because, you know, women can be strong when society wants them to, not when a woman wants to. She, you know, she's strong in the roles that society sets down for her. A mother, a goddess, you know, she, even in the story of the goddess killing the demon, she goes in to kill the demon only when her husband, Lord Shiva, begs her to do so.
Right. Yeah, yeah. It's, and, you know, the thing that I keep wondering is, because I'm comparing it to the United States, where a lot of people walk around with the idea that there's more rape now than there was in, say, the 1950s and 60s, but there is so much unreported rape in the 1950s and 60s. And I wonder, in the United States, and I wonder if in India there is more gender violence now or more reporting, more publicity.
You bring up, again, a very good point, Mary Charlotte. Again, it's been hard to gauge or get a good estimate of the real numbers because, as you mentioned, rapes just weren't reported as much 30, 40 years ago. Now, what I can tell from talking to women in my mother's generation, for example, my mom spent many years as a single woman getting an education, going to work in my hometown, Kolkata in West Bengal. And I asked her, you know, because within the community of young single women kind of going about in the city, if there are cases you eventually find out amongst yourself, even if the media doesn't report it, right? So I asked her and I asked other, you know, moms of mothers of friends, aunts, acquaintances, if they faced similar threats. And I remember my mother saying, no, you did the threat of getting molested on a bus or groped in a bus or, you know, catcalls by groups of guys as you're walking down the street. That was there. But you never came, at least she never came across. And I asked my dad as well, who had many young women friends from college who moved about independently as well. And so they never heard of cases, at the kind of brutal violence that you're seeing, that we are seeing today, was sort of unheard of back then. But then overall societal levels of violence in cities was much less than it is today. So, you know, if you talk to activists and scholars, they will say, for example, especially in New Delhi, there's been an overall rise in violence and sort of very brutal crimes in general. And the rise in gender-based violence has kind of been parallel to that. The other thing that's different between today and, say, 30, 40 years ago is that there are many, many more women out in public spaces. And so, in a sense, the increased rate of this kind of these kinds of brutal crimes these days is also related to the fact that there are more women out in public spaces. So there, so just by the nature of that, there's an increase. But also because more and more women getting out of the home, at their homes, getting an education, getting jobs, and asserting their rights has also created a shift in the overall gender dynamics in the society. So you also have a backlash against that. So, you know, it's a really interesting sort of complicated time in the society in terms of gender roles and dynamics.
We're talking to journalist Ritu Chatterjee. It's very interesting because, I mean, you write about sexism in a very subtle way and in a lot of different ways. Like, there was one young woman whom you wrote about who wanted very much to get an education, had a brutally violent father, and she just stood up to him and he beat her to unconsciousness.
She
could have died, and she got out. But I'm thinking, you know, you think about, well, it's amazing that she got out. It's great that you wrote a story about it. She might inspire others. But what's going on with Dad?
So just to give you a little bit of history. So the government of India and the nonprofit world in the last 10, 20 years has really invested quite a lot in improving girls' education. Now, the change has been slow. And especially, you know, I mentioned the urban-rural divide earlier. There's also a difference in how well the gender rights or the women's rights, girls' rights movement is doing, depending on the part of the country you live in and also sort of socioeconomic. So in this particular story, that one you're talking about, you know, this was a school in the northern city of Lucknow, which is in one of the most backward states when it comes to gender rights in the state of Uttar Pradesh. And Uttar Pradesh is a mess in many ways, aside from gender. But it's really lagging behind in terms of gender rights, women's rights, girls' rights. So, and especially if you look at poorer families, because of a lot of other cultural reasons, it makes more economic sense to people, to families, to marry their daughters off earlier, because they're considered a burden. So most families, and again, your level of education, your economic status will determine a lot of your thinking in this regard. But if you're poor and if you're uneducated, then you're going to invest more in your boy, because ultimately your boy will continue to live with you and is going to be the main breadwinner, because eventually when he gets married, he's going to bring his wife home and he's going to continue living with his parents, look after the parents. So a boy is a long-term economic investment. And a girl is a liability in many respects. She's going to marry and move to her husband's home. And then when she gets married, again, depending on what part of the country, you know, socioeconomic status, education will determine how much dowry you may have to give to the boys, to the groom's family. Even the dowry is illegal, it continues in many parts of the country. So the less educated your girl is, the less dowry you will have to pay.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah. And the less educated your girl is, the easier it is going to be for you to find a husband for her. Because what if she gets too educated? She will not find a husband who's equally educated or better educated, right? So for a lot of people, and especially in poorer communities, it is still a practice to get the daughter married early. So you find far fewer cases of really early child marriage, say child marriage at the age of 5 or 6, or although I'm sure there are pockets where it still continues. So it's illegal, by the way, to get a girl married before the age of 18 in India.
Before the age of 18?
Yeah. So the legal age of marriage for a girl is 18, for a boy it's 21. So you don't find the vast number of cases of very early marriage like you did before. And so many, many, you know, millions of more girls are getting a primary school education. But it's the middle school high school level that's the problem. So that's when parents are getting ready to get their daughters married off. Again, this is more common in rural areas, more common in lower socioeconomic status, in lower socioeconomic groups. So in this case as well, this girl had a big family. Her father had his two earlier wives had died. He was on to his third wife. She was churning out kids every year. And so for him, his priority was to get his oldest daughter married pretty early. But the reason she was able to stand up against it is because she was going to a school whose sole goal was to help girls like her finish their education and stand on their own two feet. So she had an enormous amount of support, emotional and financial support from the school. So she was able to stand up. But her case may have been sort of far at the one extreme. But, you know, it is hard. But you do find more government programs, more NGOs like this, helping girls to overcome these challenges and finish getting an education, get jobs. But it's just, you know, it's not coming up to a scale that can help every girl. And that is why in India, I think about 46 or 47, just short of 50% of India's girls are still married before the age of 18.
There's something so sinister to me about the phrase married off, but when you talk about it with that system of, as you spoke, you know, assets and liabilities of your sons and daughters, it makes sense. It only makes sense in a context where the boy always lives at home, the girl always marries and lives with her husband's family. But when that changes, you have a total change in the social fabric, which is also really hard.
Oh, absolutely. It's hard for sure. You know, 2 years ago, early in 2013, I profiled a 12-year-old spark plug of a character, a little girl.
I love her. She's like a tomboy. She's so outgoing.
Yes, Sarita. She's everyone who comes across Sarita through that story absolutely loves her. So I met Sarita in a place where I hadn't expected to meet her. This is one of India's most culturally conservative corners of India, a remote village in the state of Rajasthan, which is kind of known for ill-treating its girls and women. And Sarita is part of the first generation of girls in her village to get an education. Most of their mothers, not her mother, but most of the mothers in the village are illiterate. They never went to school. But, you know, she's the youngest of three girls. Her two older sisters are the first to leave, among the first handful of girls to leave the village for a higher education. And her parents, you know, encourage her to get an education. She's outspoken. She doesn't, you know, put up with nonsense. Like, you cannot ill-treat her and get away with it at the age of 12. She's 14 now, I guess. But even there, even with progressive educated parents, part of a generation of girls who for the first time has opportunities that their mothers did not have, even there, the overwhelming fear that dominates the family and sadness is the absence of a boy child. And it's not so much a blind cultural thing, but it's still a society where the elders depend very much on their kids. Again, in urban areas, that's starting to change. And so their sadness about the absence of a boy child is really their sadness about who will look after us. However, in cities where this has already started to change, what you actually start to see, because more and more women are getting empowered, so more and more women who are married are refusing to spend their lives looking after their husband's parents. And you have these husband's sisters, on the other hand, taking on more of the care of the elderly parents. So you're starting to see, on the one hand, while it does seem like, oh my God, who's going to look after us? But because girls, even if they're empowered, are raised with a much more of a sense of duty, when they get educated and economically independent, they are starting to take care of the parents. So you also you're starting to see that shift as well.
A lot of this boils down to really practical economic matters, like who gets paid for what. In other words, if you become economically independent because you're a scientist or because you've found some profession that pays, That was before a man's job, but nobody ever gets paid for taking care of parents or children. And it really points up the reality that wherever it is, whether we're talking about the United States or India or any other place, it's very difficult to have women's equality if you don't have real government programs and institutions like daycare, like maternity and paternity leave and things like that, that really level the playing field, because otherwise you always revert back to the situation where women's work is unpaid.
Absolutely, Mary Charlotte. You bring up an incredibly important point. And again, going back to India, and, you know, we were talking about girls' families who want to get them married and the economic realities of that. Actually, what's really changing parents' minds is when they realize, oh, when my girl gets educated, she's going to send money home as well. She's going to look after us as well. And so once they realize that, that's when their minds change. And that's when you realize how important this economic independence and, as you mentioned, economic equal pay is enabled. And there are programs and policies to ensure that.
Yeah, I mean, there's so much to it. I mean, there's equal pay, as we talked about before, law enforcement, so that women feel safe to go out in the world and do what they do. Having a job means sometimes coming home at night, and you have to feel safe doing that. And it's interesting, you wrote about the kind of invisibility of women of color in the United States, whether you're an Indian woman or a Black woman, if you've experienced this yourself. And then on the other hand, excessive visibility in India, where you don't necessarily want to be seen because you could be victimized.
Yeah, absolutely. The only thing that I would like to point out there is that the excessive visibility is, again, sort of in public spaces or feeling excessively visible, because you have that sort of sense of the risks of violence. And so the piece was really about the fact that I sometimes wish I was invisible, that I could wear whatever I please, that I, you know, that my clothes aren't sort of a, you know, a risk factor for me. You know, I don't have to think about every piece of clothing I put on as a potential risk to my life. But again, in workplace, I think women do, you know, I mostly work out of home because I'm working as a foreign correspondent. But a lot of my Indian friends will say that their struggles with trying to be visible in workplaces, trying to be heard, are sort of very similar struggles. And the discussions are often very similar to what you hear in America today. The anecdote that comes to mind, I can't remember whether it was a journalist or a writer. Anyway, a very successful woman was talking about getting together for a work meeting, and all the women have arrived and all the men haven't. And the first guy to arrive opens the door, looks at the women in the room and says, "Oh, no one's here yet."
Oh my
God. Does that sound familiar?
That's crazy.
Yeah. So, you know, it's sort of, it's those workplace dynamics, I think, are the same wherever in the world you're talking about when it comes to visibility or invisibility of women.
Well, how are men dealing with and adapting to, I mean, progressive men who are educated and who maybe want to be with equals and you know, live in cities and have professions and are not necessarily in a more of a kind of rural, whether it be caste system or village system kind of structure. How are they changing and adapting in India?
You know, the story that comes to mind to best sort of illustrate that. So right after the Delhi gang rape, which happened in December 2012, in January of 2013, I was in India and I interviewed a whole bunch of college-going young men about their reactions to the cases of the main sort of brutal gang rape, what's come to be known as the Delhi gang rape, to that case and to the, you know, protests that followed and the ongoing discussions about gender rights and gender violence. And a lot of the progressive activist types of men, even they were talking about how they were struggling within their college community they were grappling with trying to explain to other men who weren't as progressive where they were coming from. Oftentimes when they spoke up about women's rights, I think a lot of the other men, young men, who perhaps came from more patriarchal backgrounds, were considered not masculine enough. So there are discussions going on within urban educated groups about masculinity. And then there were other men who were perhaps not, wouldn't identify themselves as feminist or perhaps hadn't thought about it, but, you know, again, were educated, came from educated middle-class families, were going to college. They realized for the first time, with all the media coverage and the protests around gender violence, I think that was eye-opening for them to realize just how much women have to think about their own safety every minute. So that was eye-opening for them. And I think that sort of changed them from being neutral about this to being aware and conscious, and perhaps made them a little more comfortable about claiming themselves as feminists, or if they weren't, if comfortable with that label, at least, you know, being aware and ready to kind of jump in and help. But then there are other questions of, you know, a woman in India is always under the protection of a man, traditionally. And so there were some young men who were struggling with, well, if we see a girl getting ill-treated, not outright attacked, but perhaps catcalled or whatever, should we jump in? Because then there were questions of, or are we going to be taken as patriarchal men who are, you know, who think that girls can't protect and take care of themselves? But at the larger societal level, I think, and especially in the more patriarchal circles or patriarchal communities in the country, I think that's where things are really sort of shifting. That's where a lot of the increased violence is coming from. But perhaps that's where things are not being openly discussed. So if you're a young man growing up in a very patriarchal community, you're being told right from the get-go, you're the prince, you're the king, you can do whatever you want. All the family's resources are being put into you, into your education, your health. Oftentimes a boy is fed better in a home, in a family, than the girl. You grow up thinking you're the center of the universe, and then you step out into the world, especially if you were to go out and work in an urban community, then you see women in power everywhere. You might have a woman boss, and women are walking around way more freely than women did in the little village that you grew up in. And that's difficult to handle if all you have been told all your life is that you are the most powerful, you are invincible, you are going to do wonderful things. And that's true of even educated families who may think themselves as progressive, but somehow the gender bias kind of creeps in as to thinking of the boy as the adorable child, the one who is going to do great things, the smart one, the mischievous one. And even in, I've done some reporting in one of India's most patriarchal states, in Haryana. And it's known for, you know, it has one of the lowest, perhaps the lowest gender ratio in the country, because a lot of the female fetuses are aborted, because families don't want a girl child. Even there, and, you know, the rates of domestic violence there are very high. Today, even if you go to a village, what women are saying is that a man hits his wife once, a man hits his wife twice, the third time she will hit him back.
And that's new.
That's new. So I think that, for me, that anecdote is really telling as to kind of the power struggle going on between the two genders, even in the most patriarchal, most traditional of communities, where women are slowly starting to realize that I don't have to put up with this. I don't have to stay silent. I can do something about it.
Very, very interesting. We're talking to journalist Ritu Chatterjee. There was a photograph that went viral. I love this photograph. It was of a bunch of women scientists who were involved in a mission to Mars, and they were wearing brightly colored saris, and there was a few men sort of in the periphery of this photograph. And it really had a big effect on people. And it was, I mean, when I saw it too, I thought, this is a beautiful photograph, because these are very female, very empowered scientists working on the mission to Mars. And that kind of thing has to change minds.
That does change minds. And I wrote about this, and my blog post ended up being pretty, you know, popular as well. And that photograph was beautiful, like you point out, on many different levels. One is, you know, women in brightly colored saris with flowers in their hair. You think of them as good old stay-at-home moms who are fussing over their kids. But here they are sending a rover to Mars, you know, at the center of this mission. And that is, in a way, sort of, you know, again, points to some of the contradictions in India, that a lot of things that you know, you think of women engineers and women scientists as these suit-wearing, kind of more Western-looking women. Even I had assumed that, yeah. Even though I had worked in science, in academia in India.
Yeah, and I mean, you were trained as a scientist in
exactly,
India.
Exactly, yeah, before I switched to journalism. So even I was taken aback and very pleasantly surprised. So what that photograph does is it challenges many stereotypes. And, you know, the biggest impact, I think, for me would be, that I would imagine, is on young girls who think that they can do this as well. So I'm hoping that that's what the impact was.
One thing that I wanted to make sure we talked about, because you were saying how traditionally women go through life protected by a man, maybe first her father and then her husband or whatever in her life, maybe at some point her son too. What about gay women? What about the gay rights movement? It seems like the whole world is on the same trajectory. It kind of happens in different decades in different countries. But what does it look like in India?
So I lived in the United States for 11 years before I moved back to India in 2013. When I was when I last lived in India, and this was in the early 2000s, you know, India had just released its first sort of openly gay film, which was about these two women married to these two brothers, and the brothers were perpetually gone, and they end up falling in love with each other, these two women. And there was such a huge uproar by the right wing. And even discussing it, and at the time I was actually at a scientific institute working as a research fellow in Bangalore. And I remember there not even being conversations with my friends at the institute. It was, we felt uncomfortable discussing. Or if we discussed it with someone, it would be someone who we already knew was progressive, culturally progressive, and would feel okay. Maybe I talked about this with two of my friends. And I moved back to India in November of 2013. And I think in December of 2013 or early 2014, I can't quite remember, I attended Delhi's 6th Gay Pride Parade. So when I left India, I couldn't have imagined that I would 10 years later, 11 years later, come back to a country that was having gay pride parades. So again, huge change. Not as much as you would like it to be. Again, it's homosexuality is illegal in India. And this is because of a Victorian era law that England changed, I think, I don't know how many years ago, but only recently. But in India, we've still held on to it. And several years ago, the Delhi High Court changed that and made homosexuality legal. But then I think it was last year that the Supreme Court overturned the High Court's judgment. So the Delhi High Court's judgment several years ago was considered to be a huge step forward in the gay rights movement, but things have sort of taken a step back. But still, I think in Indian cities, big cities especially, and Delhi, definitely in Delhi, people are, you know, it's a lot easier for people to be, it's a lot easier for the gay community now than 10, 15 years ago. You know, as soon as I went back, I moved back, in the days leading up to the Gay Pride Parade, I met this couple, I think in their 40s or early 50s, who'd just moved back to India and had this gay couple. One of them was born in India, but had been living in the United States for 25 years before he moved back. And his partner is an American. And they had twins by surrogacy, and they were raising them in Delhi. And I was kind of shocked. And so I talked to them and I said, you know, is this... And they had moved from San Francisco, which has a very vibrant gay community. And you can't imagine someone wanting to leave the gay community in San Francisco. So I talked to them and I said, this must be hard in Delhi. And they said, no. I said, how come? They said, well, India is a very family-friendly society. And while a family might still react badly to discovering one of their children is gay, as long as it's not in their family and they're seeing this gay couple is loves their kids and they're a family, people are supportive and happy for them and they're part of the community. So there's a real national conversation about gay rights. The discussions aren't quite at the level of, you know, nobody's talking about gay marriage so much as to just the acceptance of families accepting that homosexuality is natural and the question of families accepting their kids, society accepting gay people. And this was really, again, very recently in the last several months, there's a very popular TV talk show done by this well-known Bollywood actor, Aamir Khan. The show is called Satyameva Jayate, and the show in general brings up issues which no one else wants to talk about but are huge issues in India. And very recently, he did an amazing show on not just gay rights, but also the transgender community. And, you know, he had guests who'd struggled immensely, people from the gay community and transgender community who'd faced a backlash from their families. But then there were families who had accepted their kids. And it was really, they showed beautifully how much family support can mean for gay and transgender people. And within a week of the show, they had several tens or hundreds of thousands of people calling to show their support for removing this Victorian law that makes homosexuality illegal in India. So again, you know, when I think of when I left India earlier in the early 2000s, I couldn't have imagined this day would come, that I would be seeing this when I moved back after 10, 11 years. But I think what if you talk to somebody from the gay community, I think what you'll hear is just how much of a struggle it is.
So it's still hard to come out and live in peace.
It is. It is. It's much better than it was before. But, you know, these kinds of biases take a long time to change. On the other hand, I have to say, though, that the big difference between the United States and India is that in the United States, I mean, it seems like the anti-gay rights movement is primarily very staunchly Christian. Hinduism doesn't really say anything about homosexuality. In fact, if you go look at very ancient temples from the 13th, 14th, 15th centuries, you actually have acts of homosexuality depicted on temples, on places of worship, beautiful, beautiful stone carvings and paintings.
Do those areas become like pilgrimage sites for gay men and women who just want to...
No. I don't think so. But, you know, I think when the Supreme Court came out and said, oh, the Delhi High Court was wrong, homosexuality is still illegal, when my Facebook feed was filled with my friends and acquaintances, professional acquaintances, putting up pictures from those temples saying that you can't say Hinduism is against homosexuality because it isn't. Look at these depictions from hundreds of years ago. So people do point to those, but they don't become a kind of a place of pilgrimage.
Right, right. Very, very interesting. Now, I wanted to ask you, I mean, there are women politicians in India, as they are everywhere, although some places less than others. The United States does not seem to be doing all that well, especially on a national level. But what is the role of women in elections? Are women, Indian women, swinging elections when there are issues of concern to them?
You know, this is where, again, I think we could see a lot more improvement. There are many women politicians, But sadly, I see far too few of them stand up for women's rights issues. And I think part of the problem is that they know they're working in a man's world, and they've had to kind of adapt to the system, the way it works, in order to be successful. So very few women politicians actually win elections by pushing gender rights issues. They don't really have much of a gender rights, women's rights, girls' education. These aren't, although I should take that back a little bit, because in the last election, since 2012, gender issues did become kind of prominent enough that I think we saw every political party, at least in Delhi, whether it was a woman politician or a man, jumping on the bandwagon for women's rights, even if they didn't have any plan. They had, you know, everybody adopted the rhetoric, women's safety, girls' rights, girls' education, protecting our women. Everyone wanted to be seen as not a feminist, but somebody who understood the need for change in terms of women's rights. But their policies, sadly, were not strong enough, and they haven't done enough to change things for women.
When you say it's a man's world, that's something that I so often think about, because the realm of what is the women's space and what is men's space and what is androgynous space, and it remains that worldwide, all of the institutions from which power is exercised were created by and for men, by and large. And I know you can't answer this, I don't think anyone can answer it, but I can't help but thinking about and asking, what would an androgynous world look like? What would a world in which men and women were equally empowered, whether it be in politics or education or anything else? Like, what changes would we have to do to get there?
That's a very big question.
I know. We've got about a minute left.
I think get all the people in power out of there and, you know, pick new people in power. I think that would be a start. But no, it's a very difficult question. And, you know, again, I can't help but think that too often you find that women, and this is, I think more true of India than in the United States, who become powerful, become vulnerable to all sort of the flip side of being powerful, forgetting what it was like when you were struggling, and just working within the system without changing it too much. That said, I do think it's important to keep in mind that we have come a long way in the last 30, 40 years, whether in India or the United States, and that, you know, what we're trying to change has been around for centuries. And human behavior, human culture is hard to change. And so it is going to happen in waves, I think. And it's just important not to let that fall off our radars anytime.
Ritu Chatterjee is a journalism fellow at the Santa Fe Institute. She's a contributing correspondent to The World on PRI. She's based in New Delhi. It's great to have you in Santa Fe, and it's great to have you on the Radio Cafe. Thank you.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. It's been a pleasure.
And we're going to go out with a song from that same protest that we started with on the one-year anniversary of the gang rape in Delhi, India. वार ये प्यार का कैसा सिला है सहजो गए बारंबार मिला है वार ये प्यार का कैसा सिला है सहजो गए बारंबार मिला है मर्दानी मूछों के पीछे छिपा है कायर सा चेहरा Thanks for listening to the podcast. To support the program, you can go to radiocafe.org. Many thanks to StudioX.com for their technical support and web design.